So my name is Mark Rodriguez. I work for a company called Aurelius that deals with representing and processing graphs or networks over machine clusters.
Okay.
I've been doing graph technology and algorithms and research for a good 10 years of my life, graduate work, postdoctoral work,
Great.
Company work when I worked for AT&T, when I worked for Los Alamos National Labs, and ultimately now with my own company, Aurelius.
Awesome, man.
Yep.
So right off the bat, what is a graph database?
So perhaps start with what a graph is,
Yeah.
and then we'll move to there, because there's
Okay.
people have the sexy aspect of the sexy aspect of software these days is the database, and there's more to graph processing than just the database. But
Okay.
that seems to be what people care about. But I think that when you're computing with graphs, there's more than just the database. So first off, what a graph is. A
Okay.
graph is a data structure where you have nodes and edges. We call them vertices and edges. That's dots and lines. And what you're trying to do is model the world in terms of things and how they relate to each other. In the textbook style graph that you get from graduate school or undergraduate, when you take a graph theory course, the graphs are untyped, meaning they're just arbitrary thing, all homogeneous, for example, all people. And then relationships are homogeneous, they're untyped. So follows relationships or friendship relationships. You don't have this intermixing or heterogeneity in the model. And modern graph systems, when we start to get into modeling the world, start to get into different types of things. There's people, there's places, there's artifacts, and there's different types of ways in which these things can be related. I can live at a place, I can purchase this artifact, I can like this, I can befriend somebody. So you start to get heterogeneous types of things and heterogeneous types of relationships. So the software community is moving away from the classic textbook representations to this more modeling-friendly representation, which is known colloquially as the property graph model.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, for a real-world example of this would be something like a social network.
Social network is your classic example,
Okay.
but think about people and artifacts. So think about not just how people relate to each other, but how people relate to other things in the world. For example, people befriend each other. People have parents. I have a mother and a father. My mother and father have their father. So you can start to now think of genealogical trees, as well as me relating to other artifacts. I
Okay.
went to this university. This university has these courses. These courses use these textbooks. These courses have these discussions. A discussion has a comment. So you can imagine trees of comments. So now you have this really complex data structure starting to merge where everything's kind of linked to each other. And then you can go even in. Marco has this particular even DNA into these proteins, and proteins relate to each other in certain ways. So you can get these macrocosm, microcosm representations within the same data structure. So then what's very nice about this is the social algorithms we use, for example, recommendation and friend following, can run within particular aspects of this graph. The genealogical data that we understand, the algorithms for understanding how certain proteins relate to each other, can start to talk about the diseases I might potentially have. And then the fact that I go to certain universities and the courses I'm in can start to understand what my interests are, what concepts I like. And concepts relate to each other. Concepts like Wikipedia graphs. You have this notion that graph theory is related to network science, related to linear algebra, related to matrices and so forth. So you have this other layer of concepts that are all related to each other. So you have this single atomic graph structure that we're trying to model the whole world in and run various algorithms through this model to understand microcosmic and macrocosmic problems and solve problems
Wow.
ultimately.
So in some sense, it sounds to me like the ultimate, like a relational database on acid. Well, not really, but on steroids.
Yeah,
So
acidic steroids.
acidic steroids, man. So, I mean, interesting, very interesting. I could see. So let's talk about the algorithm side of it then. Why don't you take us through some of this?
Yeah, so and this gets to your question initially, what the difference between a database is and the different types of processing systems. So if you look at the textbook style graph algorithms, if you open a textbook on graph algorithms, they'll talk about centralities. They'll talk about graph statistics, and I'll go. There's a couple of types of centralities. There's, for example, the PageRank that Google popularized. How do you find the most central page in the web? And a page that's very central is very authoritative. And so, by the link structure of the graph, we can say certain pages are more relevant than other pages. And so centrality is, but there's multiple types of centrality. That's PageRank. There's eigenvector centrality, which actually PageRank is based off of. If you think of a graph as a matrix, you try and find an adjacency matrix. So I can explain that really fast. You have matrix where you have all the pages and all the pages, and there's a one in the matrix if a page links to another page. So if this page links to this page, then there's a one here, so forth and so on. You have this matrix.
Okay.
You can find the eigenvector of that matrix, and that eigenvector will determine what the centrality ranking of your pages are. There's edge between the centrality. This is simply, if I take how many of all the shortest paths in the graph between any two vertices, how many times do I show up on that shortest path? So if I'm very central, if I'm between a lot of people or a lot mm-hmm. of things, then I'm very central in the graph. So there's various semantics, and there's generally centrality, but there's various different kinds of tinges to centrality. And so these kind of algorithms are very computationally heavy. These are where you're touching the whole database, and you're touching it over and over and over, multiple times. This is not good for a database.
Mm.
So when you get into the textbook algorithms that you see in school, those don't work on databases. What a database is very good at is for what we call egocentric traversals or egocentric queries. From a particular vertex, walk around the neighborhood of that vertex in order to solve some kind of problem. Don't touch the whole data structure, because you're going to just bring your system to a crawl. The disk is constantly going to be hit. You're trying to bring as much all the stuff into memory and then back down to disk, up into memory, back, and that causes a lot of problems in terms of speed. So databases, which are usually known for real-time queries, you know, want some millisecond or millisecond return response mm-hmm. times. Egocentric traversals are where databases kick in. And so what are the types of algorithms you do in egocentric traversals? And those are the thing, and the most classic. And they're all similar, but it's the most classic is like the recommendation. Given that I like these things, who else likes those things, and what else do they like that's not the things I like? So it's this three-step walk. What do I like, who else likes those things, and what do they like?
That you don't like.
That I don't like, and that's some kind of back filter.
Got it.
So this kind of walking of the graph solves you your like a recommendation problem. And same with the friend problem.
Hmm.
Who are my friends, and what other friends do they have that are not already my friends? So if you're my friend
mm-hmm.
and we share, and if I have a collection of friends and they share a whole bunch of friends in common, it's very likely that that person is also my friend. I just haven't found them in the system.
Yes.
So these are what we call triangle closures. You're trying to, there's a two line and we're trying to close the triangle. Marco knows Charles, Charles knows Bob. It's high probability Marco also knows Bob. So okay. That's where we're trying to close these triangles in the graph.
Interesting.
So all of these processes ultimately boil down to one type of operation you're trying to do, and this is called the traversal. You're trying to move over the graph. And as you're moving over the graph, you're taking what's implicit in the graph structure and making it explicit. For example, because I like these things and you like those things and you also like those things, I want to derive a relationship, I probably like those things.
Hmm.
So I'm trying to derive new information for what's implicit in the graph, make explicit what's implicit. And that's ultimately what recommendation and centrality is all about.
Interesting. So now, what do you implement this stuff in? Like, how do you write your algorithms? What programming language do you use, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, so there's a programming language called Gremlin. And Gremlin is, we call it a graph traversal language. And it's a way of specifying these walks.
Hmm.
And so when you walk over a graph, I can just emanate indefinitely. And so every time I hit a vertex, take all of its outgoing edges, and then for all those, take those outgoing, take all those, and take all those. But the semantics of that doesn't mean anything when everything can be related to anything by anything. When it can relate to my DNA, to my proteins, to the school I go to my friends. If I just constantly branch out and touch everything, it doesn't really mean anything, because there's different types of things and different types of relationships. So what you tend to do is you walk and you blind.
Mm.
So the walker is only going to traverse certain things. If I'm not dealing with disease and my medical issues, let's say, and I'm dealing with finding my friends, then I'm going to be walking on paths that have to do with friendship analysis.
Mm.
And so Gremlin allows you to do three basic operations. And all of Gremlin is broken down in three basic operations. There's something called the transformation, which is basically, given where I am now, get me to somewhere, the next step. There's something called a filter. Given where I am now, either kill me or let me stay.
Okay.
Or a side effect. Given where I am now, keep where I am now, but then alter some third-party data structure, some side effect data structure. For example, like keeping counts or statistics about my traversal. So then these, what we think about, they're little gremlins that move over the graph, like little agents that walk over the structure, transforming the structure by meaning walking over it, filtering by, as they're walking, some of them die off. Okay. For example, I go, if I'm trying to find a friendship algorithm, as I go into the medical stuff, this is not my region, die. So I'm staying within the friendship area, and then yielding some side effect. How many times do I reach Bob by going through my friends? If a lot of paths lead to Bob, then Bob might be my friend. So I'm keeping these counts, these kind of the scoreboard, so to speak. Mm. So that's how it boils down to.
So is a gremlin kind of like, is it actor based? I mean, is it message passed? Message passed with concurrency, blah, blah, blah. I mean, how do these things communicate? Yeah. I like the image of gremlins running over a graph.
Yeah.
But how do they communicate with each other?
So they will communicate. There's different implement. So the basic principle can be implemented in various ways. Okay. The gremlin graph traversal language works over various graph databases. And so when you have, and the way it's implemented is you chain together functions. It's function composition.
Oh.
So given where I am, take an outgoing edge. Given where I am, if the property on that vertex is of type location, filter. Hmm. Given where I am, update this map that says what, how many times I've seen this particular step. So let me give you an example. If I think of now this gremlin sitting on a particular vertex, and I have this hash map, and I want to find the most central things in my region. This is kind of like a localized page rank. I want to find the most central thing within in a particular region. Now, the gremlin is going to go ahead and update the map and say where I am and put a counter on it. So I'm at vertex A, and the gremlin's going to update the map, vertex A, give it a score of 1. And then he's going to branch out to all the things he's adjacent to, B, C, and D. And then those guys are going to update the map. So now I'm at B1, C1, D1. And then these guys are going to branch. And let's just go ahead and take this branch. He might come back to A. And now A is 2, 1, 1, 1. And then you see how these things keep propagating, updating this third-party data structure. And once you have some kind of quit function that says, you know, go with so many steps, or you might have some decay function in the gremlin where the gremlin signal gets weaker and weaker and weaker as he keeps going. Okay. Then when the computation stops, you have that map, you return that map to the user. That's the ranking or the scoring.
Cool. And so when the gremlin generates more gremlins, these are isolated instances of something, right? There's no connection anymore.
No. They'll communicate through this third-party data structure.
Excellent, man.
Yeah, this side effect.
Very concurrent.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Nice. So I want to step back a little bit and talk, you know, I think we have a good understanding, everybody watching this, especially with the examples you've used, page ranking. Going back to that, you mentioned sexy. I mean, I don't find databases sexy personally, but that's cool.
So in this world that we live in, I don't find them sexy either, but people tend to think they're sexy.
Yeah, but I understand. I mean, databases are those types of things that you need to use.
Yep.
So they're very convenient to store information and then access it, you know. So the other thing is we have relational databases,
yep,
like your traditional SQL. Then we have the NoSQL, sort of the flat tabular database structures.
Yep.
And now we have graph databases, which are closer to relational than they are to NoSQL, right? But talk to me about this.
Okay.
I mean, this is interesting.
So this NoSQL space, I don't come from a database background.
Okay.
And when I first was doing graphs at scale and trying to compute with graphs, I went to Google and I said, okay, I need a graph database to store my graphs and process graphs. And there was no such thing as that.
Mm.
And when I talked to friends, they're like, well, a database is a table. And you can represent a graph in a table form. You do these joins and joins and joins.
Mm.
And I said, that's pretty awkward. How come I don't have a database that represents that data structure efficiently? And so that was pre-NoSQL. And there was various kinds of tools and techniques to do graph processing, but it wasn't until NoSQL where people said, well, there's different types of data structures. There's tables, there's key values, there's big tables, it's like a single row with a lot of columns, there's graphs. So why don't we have different types of ways of persisting this data and making it efficient? So if you have a world or a domain that could be best represented by a table, then a relational database is great. If you have a world that just is very simple key value pairs, I've seen a map, a big map, mm-hmm. then a key value store will be great. If I have a world where I need a nested map, like so you have an atomic structure like a document, and within that document you might have some nesting, there's Marco, his name, his location, and then the location, some city properties, and his age and whatnot, then you get a document database. And then if you want linkages between these documents, then a graph database becomes nice.
Okay.
So these different databases that have emerged are very good at representing a particular data structure. And depending on which kind of data structure you're dealing with, you want to use the right kind of database or tool.
Interesting.
So what was your question then?
Basically you answered it. I mean, my question was, what is a graph database? That was the first question at the beginning of this, and now I think we know. Because it was important as you went through and took us through what graphs are,
yep.
what graph theory is, and these algorithms that you use, and why you would want to have a graph database. It's such that I have this graph, and I stick it into a database, and then I can get at it in a native way.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, exactly.
Using Gremlin.
Yes, exactly.
So, totally makes sense. What if I don't have a graph database, but I have a blob storage, or I have tables, not SQL, right? I don't want to have to do the rocket science of taking my graph and mashing it into a SQL data store. But you know, that's really my question. I mean, as a developer, how would I manage my graph in a non-graph database, if that question makes sense?
Yes, very much so. So I wish I had some slides because I have this in a talk. Okay, cool. you could represent, for example, you can represent a graph in a table, for mm-hmm. example, by having a person table.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want to say people live in a particular location. So then you have a location table, and these are a whole bunch of cities. Mm-hmm. And then you have all your people. And then you'll have a table called like a lives in table. And then that'll be a join on the ID of the person and the ID of the city.
Okay.
So then that's how you have these join tables that represent the connection between these two types of things.
Okay.
Much like in, let's say, a document database, you might have, again, a document that represents Marco and Marco's name. And then you say, well, who's Marco's friends? And then that'll be an array of IDs. And these are all of Marco's friends.
Mm.
But then the software system, the programmer has to say, okay, well, those IDs represent other IDs in the document database. So then now if I want to get Marco's friends, I have to de-resolve all these IDs and grab those objects. And now those objects are Marco's friends. So you can represent these things. It's just how do you want to, first of all, it's the storage ultimately on disk and how you're going to make that efficient. And second, what is the abstractions you want to deal with and how you want to think about it? Mm-hmm. Do you want the software programmer to think about having to go and dereference all these IDs and grab all the objects and pull that and build an object graph in memory? Or do you want the database to ultimately do that for you?
Okay.
And so what's unique about the graph database relative to these other database systems and why they're very different in some respect is that the atomic structure of a key value store is the key and the value. And so that's why they're very easy to scale. Because as long as a key value can fit on a single machine, I can just plop that on any machine. So all my keys and values can be partitioned and put onto all these different machines. There's no relationships between the different key value pairs.
Mm.
They're just arbitrary key value pairs, and I can hash to them and find where they are and get the value. Similarly with a document database. There's no relationship except for at the programmer level, but there's no relationship at the database level that this document is somehow related to that document. And therefore, I can just store these document blobs on a cluster of machines and just have a technique to go ahead and figure out what for a particular key on which machine that document is and grab it out.
Okay.
And so your atomic data structure for the key value store is the key and the value, or the key value, the pair, and then for the document database is the document. For the graph, the atomic structure is the whole structure itself.
Mm.
Because it's a self-referential leaking structure. So there's no way to say, okay, where do I split? And this is one of the big problems with graph databases, and also one of the problems that I work in our company to try and solve, is how to represent a graph over a cluster of machines when things can talk to each other and link to each other.
Totally. And when other parts of the graph, I mean, I have to assume that a graph can have areas, vertices, which are going to modify or create new vertices or create new relationships. That's not going to impact something else over here on the graph, so
yes.
I could see how that could be tremendously complicated. and new vertices being created. If you think about social maps in general, I mean, this actually, I want to step back and talk about computing over one of these things. Are you, and you're using Gremlin, but there's also Hadoop, right?
Yes.
That's the popular thing to use. The problem with that is when you do a Hadoop batch, you do a Hadoop batch. You can't modify in place. There's no incremental changing, that kind of thing, which is what is nice about NIAD, which is another. NIAD is a Microsoft Research, which allows for incremental computation over a large set of data, of graph data.
Oh, Dryad.
Well, it's based on, it's the cousin of Dryad. Dryad had the problem, the same problem Hadoop had. Whereas when you did a Dryad job or Dryad operation over data, that was it.
Yep.
So if you started seeing interesting results happening somewhere and you wanted to modify some a function in place without having to do a complete recompute.
Yes.
That's sort of like the incremental computation sort of thing.
Yes, yes. The database versus the batch processor.
Exactly.
Yes.
So, and this is all in memory, obviously, only. So it lives only in memory.
Yeah.
The question I guess I was trying to get at would be, in your, like, how do you confront that situation? Like,
so this is why we opened up by saying, or I opened up by saying, yes, there are graph databases, but that's not the only story.
Okay.
So there is the notion, and this is, there is the notion that I want to do, let me back up and I'll talk about how what we do at our company, if that's okay. Talk
of course it is.
Things, okay, things in our company. If you want more theory or if you don't care about the terms and whatnot. So there's three tools that we work with, that we develop in Apache 2 and open source it. Mm-hmm. One of them is called Titan. And Titan is your graph database. And that for sure has the most appeal in the community. People go, oh, yeah, cool, distributed graph database, that's what I need. Mm-hmm. But it's not gonna work for you in all situations. What it's very good for is doing these egocentric traversals. Starting at a particular vertex, do a couple search and return some results. And so, and it can handle thousands of concurrent users. So a whole bunch of concurrent users running little Gremlin queries that are all over the database, returning results and feeding your whatever the end application that's using it. And that is your flagship of data. This is just, you can throw more servers at it and you're building up this graph larger and larger and larger over this cluster of machines. Mm. Now let's say you want to do a batch job where I want to figure out something is very simple and it's very hard to do in a database is its degree distribution. A degree distribution is for every vertex, how many vertices, okay, let me read back. How many, it answers the question, how many vertices have one edge? How many vertices have two edges? How many vertices have three edges? So forth and so on. Mm. In random graphs, and what's why that's interesting in graphs, in random graphs you get this kind of a Gaussian distribution. Very few vertices have one or two, very few have a billion. Most, you know, have this kind of central, like 100,000, 1,000. In real world networks, you don't get this power, you don't get this Gaussian. You get something called a power law, where everything's shifted in one, it's skewed to one direction. Most graphs in the real world, natural graphs, if I'm modeling most things in the real world, they have this thing called a power law, and what it means is most vertices only have a few edges. Very few vertices have billions of edges. So Google, and this is where PageRank starts to kick in, where like there's very few very important web pages. Most web pages are just fluff, they would say. Mm. And so what the PageRank algorithm is trying to figure out, what are these more important pages? And so you get this kind of bias distribution, and calculating that distribution is difficult in a graph database because you have to walk the whole graph, all the edges for every vertex, and sum it up into this map of how many times have I seen a vertex with one edge incremented, how many times have I seen a vertex with two edges, so forth and so on.
Interesting.
This degree distribution. How do we solve that? We don't do that in Titan, because as you have all these users concurrently interacting with it, then you're going to just go through and sweep the whole database. You're going to pull so much off of disk, and it's just going to bring the whole database to a crawl. Mm-hmm. What we use then is Hadoop. And Hadoop is very good for these global scans of data. So what we do at a certain moment in time, I want to run this degree distribution batch job. I take a snapshot, an ephemeral view at that current moment in time, represented as a huge sequence file in HDFS. And guess what? The representation of that computation to do the degree distribution is also Gremlin. But it's Gremlin that compiles down to MapReduce. Mm-hmm. So you think of those functional atomic operations that we're doing Gremlin to walk. Those functional operations just are MapReduce operations. And so what's very nice about this architecture is that you have the same query language, but the more data you touch, it says, wait a second, this is starting to become a nasty computation. I'm going to use Hadoop to do this computation. I'm not going to do this as gets input, get a whole bunch of gets from the native database API. Mm. That's going to be nasty. I need to do sequential scans off a disk, which is going to be very, very fast.
Okay.
And you're trying to optimize for sequential scans from disk ultimately, because a sequential scan from a disk is faster than a random access to memory.
Interesting.
A lot of people don't know that.
So sequential scans from a disk is faster than random access memory.
Yes.
Randomly accessing memory.
Randomly accessing memory points in memory is going to be slower than sequentially going off of disk.
Sequentially meaning you're...
If you have a platter and you have data laid out on disk.
Yes.
Yes. You want to get, you want to read. I'm not just hopping on disk. I'm not spinning the spindle.
But how do you ensure that the bits are sequentially in place on the hardware?
So
on the disk.
This is what Hadoop is going to optimize for you.
Okay.
It's going to ensure when you write those sequence files, those key value sequence files, and you're writing a whole bunch of binary data, and it's not being updated. It's an immutable data set. You're writing this sequentially.
Okay. All right.
And so when you go back to read it, it's not changing. The problem with databases is that they change. So you get defragmentation problems. Mm-hmm. So now some of your vertex data is over here and some of it's over there and whatnot. So now the disk has to spin and you have this like notion of compaction where you try to restructure your data so it's going to get better placement on disk.
Okay.
And when you have an immutable data set where you don't have to worry about read, write, and you're just going to have one single write and potentially a lot of reads, then the system that's writing says, well, I don't care, I can just write this sequentially. And so Hadoop does that for you with sequence files in HDFS.
Okay.
And so when you have these global scans of data, you're actually getting memory speeds because you're doing sequential reads from disk.
Nice.
And that's why Hadoop is so beautiful in that respect and so fast in that respect. Well, people have there's a lot of other issues with Hadoop, but there is this notion that I can read a whole bunch of data very quickly.
So tell me, what is HTFS? I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hadoop's file system.
So basically Hadoop comes with a file system.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I apologize. You mentioned Hadoop, so I assumed you had some.
Well,
Hadoop.
I only know Hadoop from the sort of the programming abstraction.
Gotcha.
Kind of map reducey thing.
Okay, so great. So there's two abstractions. One is the data and one is the computation. So the computation is the map reduce. Mm-hmm. The data is HDFS.
Okay.
So HDFS is what you do is, let's not even worry about database stuff right now. We have a cluster, a fresh cluster of machines. Mm-hmm. And what I'm going to do is create a logical file system over that cluster of machines. So now if every machine had 10 gigs of data and I have 100 machines on them, then 10 times 100, 1,000 gigs of data over this file system has 1,000 gigs of data. Of course, 100 gigs is nothing. Let's just scale that petabytes or terabytes, whatever you want to say. So now I have a file system that is represented over all these machines. That's HDFS. It makes sure that all this data is, to the programmer, looks like one file system. So now I can just write any arbitrary file into that file system. And what Hadoop will do is not only put it on one of those disks, or if it's a massive file, it'll know how to partition it across multiple disks. It does that for you. Mm-hmm. The programmer doesn't have to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
What it also does is it does replication. So I want to make sure that if one machine goes down, I'm not going to lose a chunk of my file, a particular split of my file, so to speak. So it'll replicate data for you so that you can have machine failures. And then when new machines come on, it'll put new data onto those machines to keep that
awesome.
To keep that file system looking pure and healthy to the end developer. And so what you're storing in Hadoop are these things called sequence files. Ultimately, there's multiple different file formats, and I can store PDFs. You can do anything you want in the file system, but what people ultimately do with the MapReduce is processing these key value pairs. So what they want to represent in the file system is one big file. So if we now, let's take our graph. What I care about is representing a graph. And what is a graph? It's vertices and edges. So the key value representation of a graph is each key value pair is a vertex. So the key would be the vertex ID, and the value is all of its incoming and outgoing edges.
Interesting.
And then the next vertex is all of its incoming and outgoing edges, so forth and so on. So now if I just want to count all the vertices in the graph, in Gremlin it's g.v.count, then what it's going to do is just linearly scan. There's no indices. It's just a sequential log file, so to speak. Mm-hmm. It's just going to go and count how many rows there are and say, okay, that's your number. Now let's say I want to count how many outgoing edges there are. Well, now I need to go and I have in my value, I have all the outgoing edges. So now I go to there in the sequence file and count those. Now I want to count all steps of link two. So now when I don't have steps of length two, I only have steps of length one because I have a vertex and all of its outgoing edges. So now what I need to do is hit the reduce phase and say, hey, for this particular row in my sequence file, I have a traverser, I need to go to all of his associated data. So then the reducer phase will go ahead and aggregate all those gremlins that are going to that particular next key, all the ones that are going to next key. So all these gremlins all aggregate on the next key value for the next time you read the sequence file. And then I can do a count on that. So now I can just keep walking and walking and walking by doing these batch reads over these sequence files and propagating traversers. One thing I didn't say, and it probably might be confusing, is that not only in the data structure, when you process graphs with Hadoop using the technology Faunus, so there's Titan and Faunus is the batch analytics processor. Not only are you representing the graph, you're also representing which traversers, how many gremlins there are at that particular vertex or particular edge. So you're encoding in there the little traversers. And then you write the sequence file, load it back up, repropagate the traversers, write it back down, read it back up. So that's the MapReduce process doing graph processing.
That's really, really cool. And you know, sounds like it scales wonderfully.
So no. So yes and no. So now there's the third stage.
Yeah.
So now this is where things get crazy with graphs, because there's so many different types of computations you want to do with a graph. Mm. One of them is these local egocentric traversals, and those are very great for systems that are egocentric. And by egocentric, you log into a web system, and it's your little world, my friends, the things I've liked, and da-da-da-da-da,
sure.
And maybe two or three steps around that. And that's what a database is very good for.
Mm-hmm.
The batch processing is very good for global analytics. If you just keep propagating and keep doing like just massive, massive walks, you run into a problem with Hadoop, and this is the fat reducer. One reducer gets all the traversers onto it, and it's the slowest reducer in the whole computational stage. And if we look back at what I said about real-world graphs, random graphs have a nice Gaussian. You're not probabilistically all the reducers are going to behave the same, mm-hmm. because all of them are probabilistically going to get pretty much the same amount of traversers at them. But a power law graph, where you have a very few vertices, or a lot of vertices that only have one or two edges, and very few vertices that have thousands or millions of edges, what happens is all the reducers start to collect into them. These are called the supernodes. This is the Britney Spears, the Ashton Kutchers of the world,
okay.
the famous movies of the world, the Batman of the world. A lot of edges come into Batman. So when I walk, pretty soon Batman gets loaded down with traversers because all these traversers are bottlenecking into Batman.
Okay.
And so this is these kind of computations start to break down, and this is why models like Pragel and HEMA and Giraffe and all these what we call bulk synchronous parallel models of where you have I'm doing a walk, doing one step of computation, then the next step of one step of computation propagate traversers, next step of computation propagate traversers. Pretty soon there's one vertex just says that, hey guys, I have way too many traversers. I'm the weakest link in this chain because I got to process all these traversers and send off my messages for the next step. But then at the next step, he's gotten a whole bunch more traversers coming in. So he's always the slow guy because he has all this weight on him processing all these traversers. While the other guys, like the Joe Schmoes of the world, have one little traverser coming into him and he sends off a message, and that is very cheap. Mm. So there's this imbalance of computation within the graph. And so to combat that, Titan is your database and Faunus is your batch processor using Hadoop. And to combat that problem, Faunus at a certain point is not useful. It's not good for calculating the page ranks. It's not good for calculating these like very iterative algorithms where a lot of messages are being passed. It's very good for couple steps, doing some graph statistics, some like simple topological analyses. Hmm. When you want to get into now doing heavy iterative algorithms, you get back to memory. The way we do this is something called Fagora. And what you're ultimately trying to do when you do these iterative algorithms, and let me give you an example. We have a graph of people who are coproximal to each other. You and me have existed in some amount of space close to each other, so there's some weight between us. We're coproximal. Mm-hmm. I'm very co-proximal with my wife, there's going to be a strong weight. And my friends, there's going to be a strong weight. And my coworkers, there's going to be a strong weight. And we can imagine a graph of co-proximality, that's a word, with different weights on these edges. Now let's say a disease hits Portland, and it's an airborne disease. The CDC would love to have that co-proximal graph, because then they can know how that disease is going to propagate, because people are co-located with each other. And if you have someone like a bus driver who's co-proximal with a lot of people, well, we need to get that guy inoculated, because he's just going bam and hit everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so this is ultimately a centrality problem. I need to see how, if I randomly walk this graph, where is all the energy going to assimilate on? Where is the probability of someone becoming a receiver of this virus? And how many people is he going to ultimately infect? And so if I have the world population in a co-proximal graph, I need to do these walks to figure out who's the most central. And the database isn't good for that. That's very good for egocentric traversals. The Hadoop processor is not going to do that, because it's very good for these very short statistical analyses. I need something that's an iterative statistical analysis. And the best way we know today to do that still is putting it in memory. And so what you're going to do with this whole architecture I'm talking about is, with Titan, Titan is going to represent, it's all your data. It's who I know, what university I go to. For those universities, what are the discussion logs, and what's my DNA structure and the proteins and how they relate? I mean, just anything you want to represent. But the CDC only cares about this co-proximal graph. So it's going to extract a certain subset of that graph, which is not going to be the trillions of edges, mm-hmm. but we're starting to get down, a billion to tens of billions. And we can put that on a single machine, high memory machine, on an Amazon EC2 instance. You're gonna pay some money for it, but you're gonna do your computation, your iterative graph algorithm, in memory as best as possible, as well as ensuring sequentiality in memory as best as possible. Because again, it's an immutable representation of the graph. It's not your ever-changing database. Mm. It's a subset we've extracted for a moment to do our iterative, highly threaded calculation to figure out the most central person in this co-proximal graph. And so that's how you do those kind of computations.
Okay.
So it's every type of computation you're trying to do, ultimately what you're trying to optimize for is how you're going to represent this in disk, how you're going to represent this in memory, and what types of algorithms you're doing on them. And graphs have multiple different, they span that whole gamut. So you need different kinds of processing systems to handle each bucket of that gamut.
Interesting. Or you need to have a service, a memory as a service, right? Cloud RAM.
A cloud RAM.
Right. Always up memory, always when you need it, always when you want it. Right? I mean, I'm kidding, but it would be interesting.
Yes and no, because when you have a database, you're still mutating a lot. So mm-hmm. you have this defragmentation in memory even. I mean, the same problems you have on disk, you're going to have in memory as well. And so,
fair enough.
Yes, I would love to be in RAM all the time. But
wouldn't it be nice? Yeah. What I'm saying is, like, rather than having to spin up an EC2 instance or an Azure instance or a Google instance or whatever the cloud provider you're using is, wouldn't it be nice if you just had a service which was just RAM? Like, here, you need a terabyte of RAM, rock and roll.
Yeah.
Right? Here you go. Here's your key.
Yeah.
Give us the check. Right?
Yeah.
Here's your key. Give me your credit card, rock and roll. Use it. You're done.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that may come someday, but that's really incredibly interesting. So people using your technology seems to me run the gamut because of what you just explained to me. So you have scientists that come and use this, that are trying to do, I mean, you mentioned CDC, could also be useful for astronomy, could also be useful for any number of statistical analysis. So
yeah.
Talk to me about who's actually using these products.
Okay. Names aside, let's say.
Yeah, no names.
Yeah. Names aside, their names, you can just go to our website and figure it out, but one of our largest clients is an educational provider.
Okay.
And they have the problem, they have this notion of, there's this trend in how much time do we have? Because how deep do you want me to go?
I mean, it's fine. We have probably, I have 25 hours left of memory.
But what time do you have right now? So I have to talk. Yeah,
you do.
My mind's at 1:25.
So why don't we just answer this question and,
yeah.
and wind it down?
Okay. What time do you have?
I have 12:35.
Okay, cool. Perfect. In educate. Yeah. I'm trying to figure out how crazy I want to go, how deep I want to go. Mm. So in education, you have this notion. There's this new emerging phenomenon of MOOCs. Massively online courses. the Udacities, the Blackboards, the Pearsons, the Khan Academies. Mm-hmm. These are where we're saying, why do we have these institutions where we're just repeating one professor in all these institutions, or you know, thousands of professors, all repeating intro to data structures? That's a waste of resources when we can just record or one professor speaking to many individual students, thousands of students. So a MOOC is a massively online course. And these things are heating up. They're becoming very popular right now. Mm-hmm. And a graph is very good for modeling social interactions, classroom interactions, and that whole environment. So what they're modeling, our particular client, is there is a course. That course has particular topics. Topics relate to each other. For example, Wikipedia tell you how topics relate. That course also has students. And the course has discussions. Students are participating in discussions. Students are making comments. Comments chain to each other in a big tree. Mm-hmm. Courses are part of a university. There's other universities in the courses. Courses have a professor. Professors also teach other courses. Courses share material. They have a particular piece of material, like a book, and there's another course, let's say at another campus or another system that also uses that book. So you figure out how things are related to each other. And some of the problems that we're trying to solve with them are when you have these MOOCs of you know, 10,000 students or 100,000 students, mm-hmm. how do you scale a classroom? You can't have, you know, a proportionate amount of TAs. Well, you can, but that's just inefficient. Can we figure out a way in which, for example, we can grade students or figure out who's doing poorly or good in a class, and not necessarily by grading, you know, for like essays or whatnot, but can mm-hmm. we do these in automated means? And one of the algorithms that we've discovered that correlates very well with ultimately what someone's grade is where how they alter this tree of discussion. So if I make a comment, and that comment, we call it a non sequitur, doesn't yield any more comments, that is, and I make a lot of those comments, just because I made a lot of comments on the discussion board and they're all non sequiturs, that's not a good sign that I'm actually going to get an A in the course, ultimately. However, if I make a comment and that comment spawns more comments, which spawn more comments, which spawn more comments, that's a good sign that person's doing very good. So we study the tree depth of the comments that someone spawns.
Hmm.
And that actually correlates very well with how good that student's going to do.
Interesting.
Other kind of problems are if I'm coming into a class on let's say graph theory, and you're a social scientist, mm-hmm. this other fellow is a mathematician, and this other fellow is a physicist. If I go to Wikipedia and I start clicking around social science, I'll get into reciprocity, social networks, graph theory. If I click on it from mathematics, I'll get linear algebra, I'll get vectors, I'll get matrices, and then I'll get graph theory. If I come at it from the physics perspective, I'll get random walks, Laplacians, and then I'll get to physics, or get to graph theory. So depending on who your students are, you want to mold the concepts of your class such that you bring them into the class based upon their background experience. Mm-hmm. You as a social scientist, if I just start talking about matrices, you're going to go, I don't know what you're talking about. So we have this notion of automatically generated syllabuses that are geared towards the concepts that you come into the course with.
Sweet.
So this graph representation allows us to do these kind of algorithms that you couldn't do before necessarily until you linked all the data. And that'll hopefully help these courses to scale to handle thousands and thousands of users.
Awesome, man. Well, hey, it's been great talking to you. I think everybody out there now definitely knows a little bit more about graph theory and graph databases and, you know, how to use them and how not to use them. So rock and roll, man.
Thank you, Jarvis, very much.
And Gremlins, I really like that. I mean, that's just a great name for a programming.
Appreciate it.
Cheers.
Take care.